Star jump sequence terminates, Captain.
Get the gravitational dampers online and open the blast shield.
Aye, sir.
Bring us in closer.
Aye, aye, sir. Moving us in on sublight drive.
Extreme magnification.
Aye, sir.
The center of the galaxy. And there's our black hole.
The experience of a lifetime, Captain.
Let me put this on audio. You should be able to hear the magnetic resonance.
This is it, ladies and gentlemen. The edge of time and space, where the impossible can happen. Welcome to the event horizon.
Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, whatever is relevant for the part of the world you are in. Indeed, welcome to the Event Horizon, where the impossible happens. Join us each week at this time as we delve into the worlds of science fiction, fantasy, and science fact in all their forms. I am your host, Gene Turnbow.
And I am your other host, Susan Fox.
And with us is, I think, somebody very important in the history of science fiction at this point. He's making new history. His name is Jean-Paul L. Garnier. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And he is the deputy editor-in-chief of Worlds of If and Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine. Welcome to the show. We're very glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. Always talk. Wonderful to talk to other fans.
So, I am absolutely boggled by the fact that these two titles have returned from the dead. Can you tell us how that came about?
So the mastermind behind these revivals is the editor-in-chief, Justin T. O'Connor Sloan, who also runs a bunch of different various online magazines, focusing on speculative poetry and different things. And he happens to be related to T. O'Connor Sloan, who was editor of Amazing way back in the day. Mm-hmm. And he had the Amazing, of course, is already brought back, which is a wonderful magazine. And he was inspired by that and wanted to revive some of the wonderful magazines of yesteryear. And honor those traditions that the magazines had, but also to update them for the modern age, because we, as a lot of people are calling it, we are in a new golden age of science fiction. There's a lot of really cool material coming out. So it was his idea to bring back the magazines, and when he hit me up and said, you know, would you like to be on the editorial staff? How could I say no? I'm like, wow, step into Damon Knight's shoes? Are you kidding? Yeah, I have to.
Yeah, that's wow. Wow. So there's some history behind this. I mean, it's
there's family history.
Yeah, there's family history. Yeah. That was a surprise. I grew up on this stuff, man. I was Galaxy Inside and Worlds of If and Analog and
got some of my best memories were you know, perusing used bookstores and finding, you know, Worlds of It from the 50s and, you know, stories I'd never seen before or since. They were awesome.
And a lot of people that were writing for the magazines are still around. And one thing that we've done is, you know, try and get in touch with these folks. There's been an overwhelmingly positive response. Like, oh, my God, it's back. And I got my start in those magazines, so we're bringing a lot of writers from back in the day, and putting them right alongside writers from today. And one of the most exciting things for me was in our first issue of Worlds of If, we had writers in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. So it's like almost
wow.
Every living generation of science fiction writers and artists.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I saw the name Robert Silverberg, and we are blessed that he is still, you know, alive, kicking, and writing.
Yeah, that
he's written some of my favorite books, so it was kind of like, you know, Bob had actually contacted us, and when that came to fruition, it was just like, wow, okay, this is really happening.
that made it real.
So it's distributed primarily online now. You can get hard copies if you want them, but it's mostly an online magazine.
It's both print and digital. So the first issue that we did of IF and the first issue we did of Galaxy are both available free to download on the respective websites for both of those. And those will stay free, the first issues, but there's also print issues available for both. And moving forward, we'll still be doing print for every issue. But the digital versions, there will be a paywall on them. But we wanted to make the first ones free, just so everyone could enjoy it, see that it's back. They're still great magazines that we're honoring those traditions. But all future issues will be both digital and print.
Like any addictive substance, the science fiction, the first hit of the science fiction is free.
Yeah, this stuff is, if you're listening to this, go to galaxysf.com, and is it worldsofif.com as well? Is
that worldsofifmagazine.com?
worldsofifmagazine.com, and look them up. It's so exciting. I mean, this is not just jacking up the radiator cap and replacing everything underneath. This is the real deal. They are back. This is a return of the golden age, truly, of science fiction. And I'm looking forward to seeing what new writers come out of this. This is going to be amazing stuff.
Now tell us about the story selections in the first issues. Is it hard SF with rivets? Is it, you know, new age psychology in a future setting? Where are we with this? How close are we getting to old SF here?
I think we're producing a wonderful variety. So Mr. Sloan, the editor-in-chief, and I, we have slightly different taste, which I think is a strength for editors working together. You'll find, and we also believe, we deeply believe that readers such as ourselves gravitate towards all kinds of stories. And so we really try to have a wide variety. Like I was saying, it's a multi-generational magazine. And that's been very important to us from the beginning, to have writers from different eras and contemporary writers. And you're not going to find one type of story necessarily because of that. And we're trying to embrace all forms of science fiction. So like I love new wave writers. And so I'll pick something that's a little stranger and more on the speculative side than hard sci-fi, for instance. But you will also find that sort of story. We did find that when we put together our first issue of IF, and funny enough, we didn't really realize it until we were looking at the whole thing as one collection, that we'd sort of leaned towards medical science fiction for a lot of the stories, which was exciting to me because, you know, I love writers like Alan Norse, you know, and it's sort of a subgenre within the genre that you don't see a lot of today. And so there's these unintentional themes will develop. We were just picking great stories and hadn't really intended that. And then when we had a meeting, we were going, wow, we did a sort of a medical science fiction issue, which I thought was neat and inadvertent. So, you know, there may be themes in the future or these inadvertent themes that develop. But you will find a wide variety of science fiction in these magazines and also quite a bit of science fiction poetry. In another gig, I am the editor of the Science Fiction Poetry Association's Starline Journal. And that's actually how I met Justin, was for writing poetry and doing interviews for some of his other online magazines. So there's a healthy amount of science fiction poetry and a pretty healthy amount of science fiction art as well. Sloan has been doing an amazing job of finding the cream of the crop science fiction authors. I mean, artists rather, and authors. I mean, Bruce Pennington and Bob Eagleton, you know, when he showed me the list, I was like, holy cow. Wow.
It's not just Americans either. I mean, I see names from China. I go, Ai Jiang. I see, I'm going to offend someone, Zdravka Evdomova. You know,
yeah, she's from Hungary, I think, Romania. I think she's Hungarian, if I'm correct. So yes, it's also the lineups are also fully international. That's another thing, because science fiction is definitely a world stage today, and we're trying to have all different kinds of stories and voices. It's been really fun. I mean, one of the most exciting things about my work is, you know, by noon I've usually had conversations with people in half a dozen countries science fiction fans and writers alike. And it's really cool. You know, you get a different flavor from all different places and different concerns that are addressed in the science fiction. And that's pretty fun.
I can see I do appreciate that the visual art is fully credited in the table of contents, which you don't see every day. And one of them seems to be from, all his titles are in, I guess he must be from Brazil, because one of the titles says O Mulu do Brasil. So you're going everywhere for the art too, is my point.
Paulo's from Brazil. Yeah, it's a multi-generation and completely international affair.
So are you already feeling the weight of destiny here? I mean, you are.
There's expectations, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, with these bringing these titles back comes with expectations about what they're going to mean to the science fiction community at large and what they're going to do for future generations.
We are both completely aware of that. That's a conversation we've had many times. We are stepping into very big shoes to fill. I was familiar with the magazines, of course. I've got a pretty good big collection of both, and now I'm trying to have the complete collection. So I've been pulling them out of my bookstore. No, I have to keep these for myself. And revisiting the list of editors, it's like, okay, this, we can't mess around with this. I don't think it's ever possible to please everybody. But we hope that our taste and our selections resonate with people. I think the lineups are really solid, and, some of the folks in here, I mean, like, David Gerald, it's like, wow, he wrote one of my absolute favorite books, The Man Who Folded Himself.
I love that book. That was one of my favorites too.
Yeah, one of the weirdest time travel stories ever written. And you say time travel, I'm already in. I'm a sucker for it. Just knowing the quality of the writers that we've invited, and it's been invite only. We're not doing submissions because not yet, at any rate. Just because it's a tremendous amount of work, and we don't have time for slushing. We do mm-hmm. want to find the new writers as well. But fortunately for both of us, having worked with other magazines and run other magazines, we know a lot of writers already. And so there'll be some names that you're not as familiar with appearing in these magazines as well. Plus some of the incredible classic writers that are still out there producing incredible work.
Mm-hmm.
So you've started other magazines. Compare the experience of just starting your own magazine and then starting your own magazine with the license to the classic title of Galaxy or Worlds of If.
Well, it's different because you don't come with that pressure and the expectations. We do this first and foremost because we love science fiction, and we want it to thrive today. And so many magazines that went away in the past, it's so sad, and happened for different reasons, the war, paper shortages and so forth, or just paperbacks taking over, really. But there is a pretty there's a thriving magazine scene today. And that's wonderful because it's a place for writers to get their start, to debut their work. I mean, gosh, how many incredible authors debuted in Worlds of If, like Larry Niven, for instance. That's an incredible list. And we'd like to expand upon that because there are so many incredible writers today. And our work with other magazines has allowed us to meet a lot of these people. For instance, I run a science fiction podcast called Simultaneous Times, and I've worked with, produced audio adaptations of stories for getting near 100 different writers. Some of those are big names, and some of them are writers that we're publishing for the first time. And I think it's important not to differentiate between where someone's at in their career so much as this is a wonderful story.
So where did you find these new writers? You went to them. Where did you find them?
Submission calls. You meet people on social media. You meet people at cons. All different ways. Through working with Starline, I've worked with an incredible number of speculative poets, mm-hmm. many of whom also write fiction. So that was a wonderful introduction. And this gave us an opportunity to invite some of our favorites or people whose work we really admired that we hadn't published yet. It can be difficult to narrow down the list, though. You know, we can only afford so many stories or have so many pages in the magazine, for instance. And it's easy to get carried away because there really is a tremendous wealth of awesome science fiction happening today.
So much of the science fiction magazines, so many of the science fiction magazines just sort of disappeared around the end of the 1980s. And this pre-internet and post-literacy inflections in society, I think, were responsible for that. It wasn't their time. It became too expensive to put magazines to print if people weren't going to be able to afford to buy them. You know? So,
But how much do you attribute that to stuff like Star Wars and the explosion of science fiction in movies and television?
Oh, God.
Would people rather watch on a screen than on a page?
John Paul, what do you think?
The introduction of video games probably had a lot to do with that, too, as consoles came into our homes. You know, it's difficult to get to the bottom of, but, you know, I own a bookstore that specializes in science fiction, so my customer base is 100% readers. It's interesting, you know, there's a lot of talk of people don't read as much, book sales are down and so forth, but I think reading and writing is very much alive. I wouldn't make a living if it wasn't, so thank God it is. You know, perhaps not to the degree that I would like it to be, but it's hard to say if there is truly a decline in literacy. Book lovers, magazine lovers are voracious for it. I mean, you know, I read a couple books a week. I can't get enough. My book collection is obscenely large at this point. And then I have my store where I, you know, if there are no customers, I get to sit in my room full of books. I think, you know, as in magazines, it's been challenging. It is expensive. Paperbacks became more popular. You know, for instance, this year, an interesting observation I've had at my bookstore is I'm selling less anthologies than I used to. So I think whether people like long form or short form fiction kind of goes in and out of favor. I don't know if that's based on trends or just people's attention spans or how much time they have. You know, I think also maybe the decline of the magazines in the 80s could have had something to do with the rise in popularity of you know, doorstopper fantasy novels.
There were quite a few of them.
That's a good way to put it. Well, novels.
The thing is, you know, with a lot of these writers got too big for their boots, and they're the 500-pound gorillas that are going to sell a gazillion copies anyway. So nobody had the cojones to edit these people, and some of them really needed it.
Yeah, like J.K. Rowling. No, last two or three books.
Earlier than that, I mean, there was some you know, Mists of Avalon by Marion Zimmer Bradley. Whatever else you have to say about the woman, she sold books.
Uh-huh.
And that book needed editing. Oh, my God.
Sword of Shannara was pretty thick, too. That was like your forearm.
I didn't even get through it. Do you want to know the truth?
It's often with books like that, as an editor, I'm like, you know, I could have cut 300 pages out of this story.
Editor is not a dirty word.
Yeah, and it depends, you know. I mean, where someone is in their career will have a lot to do with their willingness to work with an editor. You know, obviously we're not infallible. We can be wrong too, and I've edited quite a few novels as well. I find it to be a wonderfully enjoyable process, you know. But yeah, I don't know. I think the popularity of long form fiction might have had something to do with the decline of magazines. But today there's a wealth of magazines. You know, whether they're thriving or not is hard to say. There's been changes in the publishing industry that have made it more difficult. I mean, we launched at a time that a lot of magazines were going under, very, very sadly, because changes that other companies were making and how things were distributed. You know, there's also only so many SFF fans out there, and we can't all read 200 magazines a month. you know.
But if you're not selling to people who aren't obviously, you know, single-focused fans, you know, there's a whole rest of a world that reads, and you have to try and drag some of them over, too.
And I think the magazine form is accessible to multiple audiences, yeah. Which is one thing that's nice about it. You know, it's not a novel-length commitment. And one thing that the bookstore has taught me is, you know, when I'm selling a book to somebody, I'm asking them for 4 to 16 hours of their time, depending on their reading speed. That's a commitment. And that's not something that people take lightly. But it's wonderful to pick up a magazine. You know, we're also publishing flash fiction in the magazine. So for those who don't have time to sit down and read, hey, this story's 2-3 pages long. You can get through it quickly and it's fun. And, you know, we are also seeing today the rise in popularity of drabbles, which are 100-word stories, you know, flash fiction and drabbles, where people can read them quickly and still get an enjoyable story. Obviously, you're not going to have, you know, rich, in-depth world building in 100 words.
No, but it's very challenging as a medium.
They're difficult to write, and there are some writers that are really excelling at it today. And I find that it's a very good entry point for people that haven't read a lot of science fiction but want to get started. Or a lot of customers in the bookstore will tell me, you know, I don't have much time to read anymore. And I'm like, well, I have an anthology for you. You know, each one of these stories will take you less than 5 minutes to read. And it's a wonderful way to get introduced to a lot of new writers. You know, if I meet some writers, you know, or readers rather, that they want 50s and 60s science fiction. And I totally get it. I mean, I'm stuck in the late 60s, early 70s in my reading a lot of the time. But they want to be introduced to contemporary writers. And a magazine with short form stuff is a wonderful platform to do that, because you can get a taste of someone's style and ideas fairly quickly.
Are we making them available to vision impaired? Are you doing your own audio versions?
So I do a lot of audio science fiction stuff for my podcast, Simultaneous Times. It is an incredible amount of work, and it is very expensive to produce. So we haven't done audio versions of the magazines yet. However, we did go back and select some wonderful stories from Worlds of If back in the day, and I did some audio adaptations of those, which you can find on the Worlds of If website, just as little teasers before the magazine launched. So that was fun to work with some classic stories. For magazines also, it's sort of a cost issue, because it's a different set of rights that are being purchased if you're doing audio. It's different than print rights, and so that's sort of a legal and financial complication.
40 years ago, it wasn't so much of an issue, you know, because nobody thought that, oh, a recording of a book might be worth something.
I mean, you had the radio adaptations and wonderful programs like, you know, going way back in the day, X-1 and Dimension X.
We have those on Sci-Fi Radio.
More recently, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, programs like Mind Webs, which was one of my favorite, you know, audio adaptation shows. So there's a rich history of audio stuff. And, you know, Galaxy Magazine had worked with a lot of the, you know, not just Galaxy, but many of the magazines had worked with some of these radio programs to produce stories. I know I've listened to a lot from Galaxy, of course, from Astounding and / Analog. So that's a very close to my heart thing. I grew up listening to radio dramas, which is why I do a audio fiction podcast. And we did, for the first issue of If, we did do a collaboration with my podcast where we did stories and poems from our first issue of Worlds of If. There's a Bob Silverberg story. So there was the one. Whether we'll do more of those or not, I don't know. It's financial and time constraint oriented answer for that one.
Yeah, it's expensive. I mean, we have that's the reason that we don't read books on the air. Back when KPFK was doing it,
there was a late night show called Hour 25, because it was on at 1 a.m. and they would have readings, and often the authors would be involved with it, and they just blast them out over the air, and I would just record them on my little cassettes. Harlan Ellison was a fantastic reader.
Oh, he was
good. If that writing thing hadn't worked out for him, I think, you know, acting could have been his other career.
I keep wondering if we're going to have to see a new iconoclast of science fiction rise since we've lost Harlan. I feel like that's something that the genre is missing right now, is the cantankerous iconoclast.
He was born cantankerous, though.
Yeah, David Gerald is trying to step into those shoes. But
he's been trying to step into those shoes since the 70s.
And he's the nicest, sweetest man you'd ever meet. And he's trying to put on this gruff...
get off my lawn.
Get off my lawn thing. And it...
And
it
then he shows pictures of his grandchildren.
It,
I mean,
just
come on.
Doesn't fly, David. Nobody believes it.
He still
You're
writes a good
nice man.
Still writes a good stick, though.
Yeah.
He's been very kind when I've met him, and I absolutely adore his writing.
He's been very supportive of me and my writing.
Yeah. Well, he was kind of the role model for very young people. I mean, he sold The Trouble of Tribbles while he was in college.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You know, if he can do it, we can do it. Well, maybe not, but we can try at least.
Yeah, it gives us all hope, you know? And when somebody like that steps up and says, not only, yes, you can, but here's what to concentrate on. Here's how you go about it, which that's what David did for me.
I think it's the paying it forward attitude is extremely important, and that's why we also have younger writers in earlier stages of their careers. It's always important. I mean, we're going to have nothing to read if we don't nourish the younger writers and help them along the way. And it can be a very difficult business to navigate without some guidance, without someone to help you along. You know, writing is such a solitary affair. But, you know, once it comes time to publish and meet people, that, you know, there's no guidebook for this. And I think it's really important that writers with experience that have been doing it for a while reach out to help others. And that's one thing with the magazines. You know, we don't differentiate. Your name's going on the cover, right, with that big name that wrote all those classic books we love.
I know, right? I was very excited about that. I'm going, somebody's, you know, I don't know all these names, but I bet they're thrilled as hell to be in the same page with, you know, David Brin and Bob
Silverberg.
And, you know, artists often weren't credited as they should have been. You know, we all love the artwork, the imagery, the paintings, you know. You know, Berkey's paintings. I wish I could afford one.
Oh, Berkey, the Berkey covers. Oh,
yeah,
they're incredible.
I learned to oil paint by reproducing his covers. That was one of the pivotal things about my my late childhood, is studying his covers and Kelly Freya's covers, and just learning to paint by studying their work.
I mean, these are the images that inspire us to write too. I thought it was a wonderful move to put the artist names on the cover, put them in the table of contents. You know, I look at my old collection of books, and oftentimes the artists aren't credited at all. And you're going, wow, this is a spectacular piece. Who did this? And so we wanted to change that. You know, everyone whose work is in these magazines is incredibly talented, and they all deserve to be acknowledged in that way. And, you know, as a writer myself, you know, getting your name on that cover is quite a feeling, you know. Not all magazines list all of the contributors on the cover. And that was a decision we made early on that I think is really important. I mean, this is the talent in the magazine. Let's put their names right up there.
Now, my only note about the table of contents, you've got art and you've got literature. You don't have the stories broken down by shorts, novels, novellas, or poetry. And I'm going, which are the poems? I don't know.
And I think, okay, noted. Okay. We'll have a talk about that.
Now, I think science fiction poetry is a rising movement at the moment. The Next Worldcon committee has committed to a Hugo category for science fiction poetry. And I think all the poets need to know that.
It's an exciting first. There's rumors about potentially a nebula at some point, too, which would be really cool. Yeah, the SFPA, who I work for, the Science Fiction Fantasy Poetry Association, was actually started by Suzette Elgin. Mm-hmm. Because CIFWA wouldn't recognize poetry. And that's changed in the last couple years. CIFWA actually started recognizing poets as and poetry sales as a qualifying factor 2 or 3 years ago.
Wow.
So that's a new thing. Speculative poetry is on the rise, which is really cool to me because it's something that, I mean, you go back to the pulp days, it was there. Not all the magazines published it, but you often found it in the fan letter sections.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there'd be, you know, someone taking a whack at the editor in form, you know, telling why they didn't like a story. And then the editor might even argue back through poetry. So there's a long tradition of it, but for some reason not recognized. SFPA started in, I think, 1978, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a thing. And Starline magazine that I'm also editing for right now, you know, it's in its 46th year.
Wow.
Going into its 47th year. So there's, and it's a lot of the writers that you'd recognize. You know, the big poetry awards have been, you know, Ray Bradbury's an SFPA Grandmaster, for instance. Joe Haldeman mm-hmm. has won some, I think, the Risling Award. You know,
but these people are people. These are people whose prose is almost poetry in itself. Elgin and Bradbury are ones that leap out at me in this conversation.
Absolutely, and many of them wrote poetry too. Yeah. You know, some of my favorite writers, like Thomas Dish, was a poet too.
Yeah.
You know, his poetry is very hard to find now, but he had a substantial output of poetry. You know, as well as some really wonderful bonkers novels.
That's the I
bonkers is the word.
Bonkers is the word. I remember him putting his name on a whole bunch of Star Trek books. You know, and
you know, it's a living.
Yeah, it's a living. Somebody's got to you know, you've got to pay the bills.
I would do it in a heartbeat. I get it.
Yeah. It's awesome stuff. I think he didn't necessarily do all of his research before he started some of these books.
That's a thing with tie-ins. That happens.
Yeah. Well, but that's what their editors are there for. I mean, I'm sure he had notes.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. I'm just thrilled to death that all of these titles are coming back, and I'm
our inner little fanboy fangirls are jumping up and down.
Oh, yeah, really. I'm
was
looking
also
for
my response, by the way. That was my exact response.
Yeah. Going, maybe there's not a newsstand to go pick it up on anymore, but that just means I don't have to leave the house for it.
I hope to be able to submit someday. So.
Well, wait till they start taking submissions.
Yeah, it's got to wait until you open submissions.
Okay. Eventually, the magazines will open to submissions, but since you know, building a magazine up from the ground and getting started is a lot of work. We thought, God, we're going to be spending so much time reading Slush. We know the enthusiasm's there. So let's build some great issues, get the business end together, you know, iron out any kinks that come along the way. Then we can open it up. You know, like one thing, Worlds of If had a tradition of debuts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we'd like to bring back too. You know, hey, your first publication is in a real slick magazine with great cover art and other amazing writers.
Are you concerned about the impact of AI-generated crap filling up your submissions queue?
Not if they don't have a slush pile, they don't.
Well, sooner or later, you're going to open your slush pile. And
well, as an editor in general...
It might be a snowstorm, not just a little, you know...
The good news is the work is crap, so it's easy to identify and say no to. I absolutely have no interest in AI and the humanities. It belongs on robotic spacecraft, in traffic lights, in the medical industry. It has no place in the humanities. It's the machinities. It can't even qualify as the humanities.
The machinities.
Ooh, I like that. We're
going to
use
good.
That expression
I like that.
Now.
Fortunately, the artwork is really easy to identify, and I don't care for it. Even at my bookstore, I have a zero AI policy. I don't want it. I'm not interested.
Mm-hmm.
I even made it public that any press using AI for cover art, writing, slushing, or editing is not welcome in my bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
Readers don't want it. Keep it for the tech bros. Leave it, you know, it belongs in certain sciences. It does not belong in the humanities. So absolutely zero interest here. Is that something as an editor that has to be weeded out in the slush pile? Absolutely. It's a time drain. It shouldn't be paid for. It can't be copyrighted. And it's a plagiarism machine. So I am against it 100%. It's an annoying thing in my job, like with other magazines I work for in my podcast. The contract has to state that the author has to state that they didn't use any AI, LLM, you know. I hate that we're calling it artificial intelligence because it's not.
It's not really.
It's artificial stupidity.
It's pattern matching and confabulation. It's not actually smart. It doesn't know what it's doing.
Agreed. Absolutely. And, you know, I know for some of the big magazines in the field, like, you know, Clark's World had a lot of trouble with that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, they had to shut down their submissions entirely because they got snowstormed with it.
And it's basically scammers thinking they're going to make a quick buck. And boy, did they choose the wrong business for that. The joke's on them, you know.
Nobody gets rich off this stuff. You do it because you love it or you don't do it.
Absolutely. And, you know, those of us that dedicate our lives to this, it's offensive. You know, it's as a science fictional concept, it's something that I would like to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in our books. Sure. Let's do that. You know, if there was a sentient AI, I would love to sit down and have a conversation about philosophy.
We all like to play with it, but we would never consider using it as our work output.
Well, a lot of SF is stuff that you don't really want to deal with, is it? I don't want flying cars. I don't trust these people in two dimensions, far less three.
Agreed completely. You know, I mean, we're not all predicting that. You know, what did Ray Bradbury say? I'm not here to predict the future. I'm here to prevent it. Something along those lines. You know, and I think that's one thing that SF could be good at.
Well, that's one of the three questions that science
fiction asks? The three
questions.
It's what if only... And if this goes on, and
if Ray Bradbury's thing was if this goes on, and sure enough,
there it was.
Yeah, unfortunately, science fiction predicted some things that didn't turn out so well that, you know, it got right. But there's also predictions that are hilarious. Like, I think Heinlein predicted the waterbed.
Yep. It was right at near the beginning of A Stranger in a Strange Land. I remember my parents had a waterbed, and I was just reading that book. And I'm going, hey, we've got this.
And televangelism, he also predicted in that
book.
Oh,
boy, howdy.
Which, you know, was sometimes what science fiction gets right is surprising, you know.
These are the crazy years.
And thank God there aren't flying cars because, you know, just being on, I live in the middle of nowhere. So when I get on the highway towards the city, I'm like, wow, everyone's gone insane. Thank God that's not happening in the air.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think AI would be the only way that, flying cars could ever work because you can't trust humans to do
well. That's
the
it, they'd have to be work. Controlled, computer controlled rather than human,
which I don't trust either.
Yeah,
but you know, on a Mars rover, absolutely, you know, that would give us that could deal with our time lags in communication, and speed up space exploration, mm-hmm. robotic space exploration. That I would love to see happen.
Turned out we were pretty good at robotic space exploration. Our stuff lasts much longer than it should was designed for.
What the
opportunity that opportunity. Was years past its freshness date and voyagers that are still squirting information back. Who thought it? You know,
like 25 years later, Voyager is still out there sending us.
It's absolutely
sending
amazing.
Us science.
You know, I think that's where these technologies should be applied, and certainly not to art and literature.
No.
You know, and it's funny today to, you know, feel like a modern Luddite, against these technological advancements. And I've even had people ask me, you're science fiction people. Shouldn't you be into this stuff? And I'm going,
and we are. We're fascinated in how it works. We're fascinated in what it does. But it does not replace human expression.
We also have more practice at figuring out what the future implications will be. And I think that's what separates the science fiction people from the rest.
I mean, they're fun to play with, but I would, you know, you would never want to publish anything or release anything with this stuff in it.
When the SFPA was developing our no AI policy, which fortunately the membership voted to uphold, which was an interesting, very long conversation. You know, one of the things I kept going is, hey, we told you so. We warned you about this.
Right?
Now it's here for your jobs. It's here for our passions. We have to block this immediately. And, you know, not everyone feels the same way about it.
Let them start their own organization then. They can start their own website with their machine-made, you know, stories. And
I'm sure there's people doing it. But, you know, as someone who owns a bookstore and my livelihood is books, I can tell you 100% readers are not interested in this stuff. Readers want to connect with another human being. They want to learn about empathy. They want to hear another person's thoughts. I mean, reading is a form of telepathy where you're in the mind of another person. It's the only technology that can do that, that can make you think someone else's thoughts as you're reading. And that there's something magical and really special about writing and books in that way. And that's what readers come for. They don't want a string of words that has been randomly put together by something that hasn't considered the meaning of what they're saying.
Yeah,
I think that's been the case since the Epic of Gilgamesh and you know, clay tablets.
Oh yeah,
we are reading the thoughts from thousands of years ago
to speak to those yet born. You know, yeah. And that's an important heritage of what writing is. And in my experience, 100% of the readers I deal with, which is a lot because that's what I do all day every day. That's what they come for. That they're not interested in what machines have to say.
Nor should they. I mean, if as a writer, and I caution anyone who's considering using AI to write a book or something like that, if you can't be bothered to write the book, why should you expect anyone to be bothered to read it?
Indeed.
Absolutely. So, and it's sort of a weird thing, like, you know, if you're making AI books, because writing's not the right word, why have you gravitated towards being a writer? I mean, I think all of us that write gravitate towards it because we have a yarn to spin. You know, we have a tale to tell and things we want to say. If you don't have that drive, then maybe consider a different field.
Yeah.
We're going to grow into programming. I mean, one thing I'd said early on when this mess first started was, if you wrote the software, we can talk about it. And I've written generative software before, music generative software. I wrote the software. I was involved in the art making. If you're using someone else's software, I don't want to talk about it at all because you're just pushing buttons and entering keywords. You know, if you have the dedication to sit down and invent a machine that does this, now that's an interesting conversation and perhaps we can have it. But it's not poets and writers making this software.
That's for sure. Not. No, it's not.
So speaking of your bookstore, where's the bookstore? What's it called? We all need to go shopping there.
It's called Space Cowboy Books, and it's in Joshua Tree, California, out in the Mojave. I'd wait till fall starts because it's really hot and smoky out here right now.
Yes.
But it's a science fiction specialty shop. It would be 100% science fiction if I didn't have to make a living, but I have to carry a little something for all the readers. But it's a weird little dream come true for me. You know, when I first opened, which was 9 years ago, people came in and they would go, a science fiction bookstore in the middle of nowhere, you're insane. And I'm like, yeah, I'm insane. This is my dream. But that was 9 years ago. So obviously there's been enough people that love what's happening too. And the plan from the beginning, which has happened, is it's developed into a publishing house as well. Mm. Now, to just for clarification, Starship Sloan, which is the parent company of Galaxy and Worlds of If and several other magazines, is not my company. I work for Justin Sloan. Space Cowboy is its own entity. It's the bookstore, podcaster, and publisher. So obviously, science fiction has taken over my life, which was exactly what I intended to happen. Science fiction was one of those things that throughout most of my life, I didn't know other fans. I was sort of at it alone. And just loving books, but not really having anyone to share it with. Hmm. And opening the bookstore just opened the floodgates of fandom and getting to know other readers.
That's so good. And if you build it, they will come.
That's been the funnest thing about it. I mean, aside from, you know, before that I was working construction and now I own a bookstore. It's like my quality of life has improved drastically. It's not a terribly lucrative profession, but it is a profession filled with love. And it's a very intimate profession. I mean, we all have very special feelings about the books that we love and getting to share those with someone else. It's like getting to share an experience that you went through. that, you know, for most of my life was something that was completely solitary. And it's amazing to me that that's a huge chunk of my day. It's just, hey, tell me about the books you love. I'm like, how long do you have? Because I can carry on.
Somebody asked me, what's my favorite book? I'm going, which is your favorite child? I mean, come on. I don't know.
Yeah, let me pull out this list that's taller than I am see if you can stick around for a few hours, which happens, you know, and that's a wonderful experience, too. And to get to share those things and carry books that you might not find at other bookstores. I mean, one of the biggest reactions I get from science fiction fans that come in is, wow, my local bookstore has this teeny little shelf in the back. You know, here it's half the store, it's loud and in your face, it's everywhere you look. And it's not just, you know, the Barnes & Noble style where you'll just have Dune, you know, that's it. It's like, no, I've got Frank Herbert's other 50 books too. You know, these writers didn't just write their one hit. They were all extremely prolific. And
it's like top 40 radio.
That's what it feels like going into a big box bookstore. And this is more, you know, like an underground record store. Oh, here's all the stuff that wasn't the hits. Oh, their first single, you know, and the more obscure works.
You probably haven't heard of them.
And, you know, I've got back to the magazines. I've got magazines from the 40s all the way up till today. I don't bring anything pre-1940s down because I do have a collection of some 30s magazines. And, you know,
you look at them wrong. That's got to be fragile by now.
You look at them wrong, they turn to dust, so I don't want customers touching those. But and it's not just science fiction magazines. I've got old Western pulp mags, it's the magazine world was wonderfully diverse. I mean, at one point there was even boxing stories magazines, you know. So to try and keep that alive and to, you know, especially a lot of younger readers that come in today, they haven't ever seen this stuff before. And so it's really fun to turn people onto it and be like, no, you know, for a genre that's, you know, of course, there's a lot of arguments for how long science fiction's been around, but, you know, right around 100 years, you know, we've been calling it science fiction for 98 years. So for a young genre, I know there's a lot of argument there. We could go into that later.
No,
but
I got it.
It's a matter of perspective.
It was Hugo Gernsback. It was 1926.
And it's covered a lot of ground in that time. Yeah. You know, you get into proto science fiction, it's a whole nother conversation. But, you know, one thing that's really cool with readers, they come in and if they're not super familiar with science fiction, I go, well, you know, pick a theme and tell me what kind of theme you're interested. Because in the anthology section, I mean, I've got everything from science fiction about moms to science fiction about dogs to you name it. You know, there's an anthology covering that. You want Galactic War? We've got it. You know, you want Valentine's Day stories? We've got that too.
A lot of interesting stuff is coming out of going into public domain. Are you going to consider, you know, using some of that from names that we still know?
I published a book last year called Another Time, which is time travel stories from the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. So I do a little bit of that. And I'm working on some anthologies. I'm working on one called Drunk on the Moon, which is all science fiction stories about booze.
I mean, this book.
If you dig through enough of the old pulps and read the old magazines like I do, and you pick a theme, you could probably put a collection. So that's something fun I've sort of been doing on the side slowly.
I want to write the recipe collection, you know, drink recipes for that one.
I want to write a short story about rum running on the moon and call it moonshine.
Bah-ha-ha.
I think it'd be good. It's a good hook.
There's a lot of fodder there. And like I said, science fiction's covered so much ground that it's easy to do. And one fun thing about reading through the old magazines to put these anthologies together, you know, I also spent quite a bit of time reading Old Galaxies and If just to re-familiarize myself with the magazines to make sure we're doing a good job with the titles. Is, you know, there's names that we all recognize, and there's a lot of names that disappeared, or it was an obscure pen name, or it was just a one-off story for that writer. And that's been really cool with the anthologies I'm doing and reading the old magazines to discover these sort of forgotten writers. Mm-hmm. And I'm not the only one doing that. Like Journey Press has done the Rediscovery series of all women science fiction writers They've done three anthologies so far. Those are absolutely fantastic. And, you know, there's names that everyone would recognize, of course, but there's a lot of names that you might not have seen before just because the work didn't stay in print, especially from the early days of the magazines. You know,
like,
there's so many.
One author whose name comes to mind, J.F. Bone. That was my father's pseudonym, and he sold a stories to, I think, Galaxy Science Fiction.
We've got to find it.
You know, back in...
He doesn't have it anymore,
no,
does
he doesn't have those
anymore. We got to find out what issue it was.
But when he was in college, you know, he...
J.F. Bone? I'm going to have to look that up because I have a big collection. I'm going to have to find these. How cool is that?
Yeah. I mean, my dad started about... I didn't even find out he was a science fiction writer until I was like in my 40s.
And then he had done it when he was in college,
when he was, you know, 21, 22, and he would sell stories, and it was like the most money he could make in a week doing anything else at the time.
And apparently it's in the blood. I mean, Justin Sloan, you know, his not only was T. O'Connor Sloan editor of Amazing, but he also edited quite a bit of Asimov's work.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it does run in the family.
Yeah, I guess it does. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking to Jean-Paul L. Garnier, the proprietor of Space Cowboy Books in Mojave.
Joshua
Tree. In the Mojave Desert, Joshua Tree, Space Cowboy Books. He's also the deputy editor-in-chief of Worlds at Fifth and Galaxy Science Fiction, both of which have been resurrected and are back in print. I am so grateful that you were able to join us on this episode of The Event Horizon here on sci-fi.radio.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to seeing both of you in person at LostCon this year as well, which is right around the corner.
Yeah, I'm running the Maker's Room. So, yeah, we'll see you there. You have been listening to episode 277 of Sci-Fi.Radio's production of The Event Horizon for September 21st, 2024. Our guest this evening has been Jean-Paul Garnier, who is the deputy editor-in-chief of two newly resurrected science fiction and fantasy periodicals of historic importance. They are Worlds of If and Galaxy Science Fiction. You can find more about these publications at galaxysf.com and worldsofifmagazine.com. First issues of the new publication run of each may be downloaded for free. This show will air again tomorrow, September 22nd at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, and again on the upcoming Thursday and Saturday mornings at 4 a.m. Pacific, 7 a.m. Eastern. After all of the airtimes have passed, you will find this episode and others on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbay FM, Pandora, Stitcher, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and on our own website at sci-fi.radio. If you enjoyed the programming you have just heard, please consider visiting patreon.com/sci-fi-radio and become a patron of the station. We are listener-supported sci-fi and fantasy fandom radio, and your contributions go to paying our DJs, our production team, the writers for our Geek News website, our business operation fees, our music licensing, and a lot more. And they help us procure and maintain the equipment and other resources we need to stay on the air. We have been broadcasting continuously since 2009, and we are grateful for the support of listeners just like you. That URL is, again, patreon.com/sci-fi-radio. The Event Horizon on sci-fi.radio. It's sci-fi for your Wi-Fi.